Well, you know, it's a real talent to be able to take a complex topic and share it with the general public in a way that is both clear and exciting. Not all scientists have that ability for sure. So I think it falls on writers and reporters to bridge that gap. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. One person who has made a career of communicating effectively about science and also teaching others how to do it is Deborah Blum. She's Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, the author of several books, including the bestseller The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. She's a professor at UW-Madison and edited the 2014 edition of the Best American Science and Nature Writing. It is a fabulous book, and great to have Deborah back. Thank you so much.
Thank
for
you
coming.
For having me here.
Well, it's wonderful, and I really want to talk today about communicating science. We certainly want to talk about the book, for sure, and the articles in the book, and invite our listeners to join in. Is there a science or nature topic you wish was better covered and communicated, or maybe there's a science communicator who you really enjoy? I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Well, Deb, you really excel at communicating complex topics to a general audience in a very interesting ways. What do you think are the most important aspects of effectively communicating science?
Well, I think for me anyway, everyone may have different philosophies of this. It's that we want to write science in a way that people see it in their everyday life. I mean, I think too long in the way we teach science or write about science, we tend to present it as a brilliant idea discussed by people smarter than you that has nothing to do with your daily life. And that's completely not true. Science defines so much of who we are and our life on this planet, and everything from how we cook an egg to how we change the atmosphere. And so for me, one of the most important things that science writers like myself do is we see it in everyday life, and we tell the stories in a way that we want to pull you in closer to what I always think of as the science campfire. You know, don't stand out there.
Yeah, come
on closer. Right.
Yeah, come on in. Well, I should have had you and Bassam Shakashiri on sometime together. I'm sure you know Bassam.
I do. I'm a huge fan of his work with chemistry and communicating chemistry.
And he has very, very similar ideas and thoughts about communicating science to everyone. And so I wish we'd done that. I think I'm really pleased with with the collection of stories that you put together for the 2014 edition of the Best American Science and Nature Writing. I mean, this is and it made the New York Times list of best-selling science books.
I know, that was so exciting to see it as a New York Times bestseller. I've asked myself whether 2014 was just an amazing year, because I had such a hard time whittling down to the collection in this book. And even when I go back, I'm just going to sound so full of myself when I say this, but when I go back and read these stories, I just think, wow, they're such amazingly interesting and good and challenging, provocative material.
Yeah, and it amazes me. And I think one of the cool things about good science writing is that at least for me anyway, I was able to draw on past experiences and the O-ring piece, where I was during the Challenger and thought a lot about that and how our President Reagan at the time communicated to us.
there's this wonderful piece called O-Rings, in which the writer, it's just a gorgeous literary piece, but it's written by a planetary scientist who writes in perfect English, but she is actually down in Antarctica. And so she sort of draws an analogy between the dangers of Antarctic exploration and, in fact, really early explorations on that continent where people died, which involved, I don't want to give the whole thing away, but which also involved a failure of O-rings, which are flexible seals that we use in all kinds of engine or storage materials. And the way she tells that story is compelling, but she takes you to the Challenger, which explains again what happened there, in which the rocket boosters, they launched the Challenger in a period of unusually cold weather in Florida. The O-ring seals on the rocket boosters, which contained that very explosive propellant, failed in the cold, stiffened and failed, and the Challenger exploded. I was one of the reporters who went to Houston after that disaster. It was so traumatic to go, right? Because I went to Johnson Space Center, you know, the day after all these astronauts had been killed. The place was in lockdown. There were reporters spilling everywhere. And the most important thing was that all these people died and no one had understood why. She puts that in this amazing context that also looks at who we are as human beings and why we choose to explore improbable frontiers like the Antarctic or like space or even who we are, because in a lot of ways, understanding ourselves is a last frontier. And you get to the end of that piece and you're just kind of both wow, and for me, I don't know if I'm as brave as that.
It's an amazing piece, and it brought back so many memories to me because I was in St. Lucia working, and so I was out of the country, and it was one of those times where you really wanted to be back.
Yes, I.
You understand what I mean?
I do. You wanted to be there, right? Yeah. Because it was your home, and this had happened on your home. It's like when September 11th happened.
Yes.
My older son was off on a school field trip from Madison, and he did not return to the following day. Mm. All I wanted, he was little.
Yeah.
I wanted him home, right? Yeah. I wanted to gather him in.
We have callers online. By the way, if you would like to join in at on the program and talk with Deb Blum and maybe have some questions for her or some comments, love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Tom and Delavan, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
On 9/11, we know what happened. We saw three buildings blown up in New York City. The way I know that is that there's 40,000 cubic yards of concrete in each of those towers. It was broken and pulverized in less than 15 seconds. Only explosives can do that. And I want to know why the science community has been silent now for 14 years.
On this topic? Deb, comment?
You know, I see a different explanation of that, right? I never saw anything, and certainly as always with any kind of catastrophic event like this, you're going to have a lot of wondering about whether the whole story came out. What my understanding of that event, and I'm going some by what was covered by major newspapers who brought in a lot of engineers and other experts, was that the real issue, at least in the collapse of Twin Towers 1 and 2, was that the planes embedded in that building. The planes themselves were carrying an enormous amount of highly explosive fuel. Fuel's explosive. Mm-hmm. Fuel burns at an extremely high temperature. We saw that in Challenger. Mm-hmm. We saw that here. The fuel from the plane ignited and exploded, and we're now talking about tens of thousands of gallons of fuel. The steel supports in that... There goes my voice. The steel supports in that building were not designed to withstand a fire of that heat. And what we found, and what certainly what the engineering analysis showed, was that there was a catastrophic melting. And as the steel supports of those buildings melted, the building simply fell apart and showered down. The one thing I will say that is still being discussed in the wake of that sort of catastrophic failure is what were the materials that were released into the air. And there was a lot of concern, and the gentleman is certainly right that we don't know every chemical compound that was sort of spewed out there, because we have later seen chemical-related illnesses in emergency responders that are still sort of plaguing some of the emergency responders in New York City. And there is a lot of debate over what we knew. Did we fully understand what was being released into the air? Do we fully understand those airborne risks? And that's a legit, that I think is a legitimate question and should be discussed further.
Talking today about effective communication about science and nature with our guest today, Deb Blum, who has edited the best American science and nature writing of 2014. Great to have her along. I hope you'll join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. What makes a good science story? How do you best communicate it to others? I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at science and science writing and effective communication about science and nature with our guest, Deborah Blum, who is the editor of the really one of the finest books out in 2014, in my estimation. It's titled The Best American Science and Nature Writing. Great to have her along. Certainly, if you'd like to join in with questions or comments, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Would love to hear from you. Let's turn to Carl in Madison next. Carl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the program. I have a question. My interest is in the area of environmental protection, and particularly issues around climate change. And anyone who digs into the peer-reviewed research on kind of where we are and where we need to go, given what scientists are telling us about the changing planet, knows the complexity and also the potential real threat to this world that we live in. And it seems that there's a kind of a double-edged sword. People in the lay community tend to absorb information through story better than simply fact and figure, particularly if they're going to be asked to act on it. And then the other side of it is that many scientists feel that it's just not their culture or their calling to venture into the realm of advocacy. They're more dispassionate and review the research or conduct studies. And in this particular case, we have a fairly short period of time to travel quite a ways in terms of how we burn fossil fuels and how we treat our planet in a way that will allow future generations to continue to live here. So I was just curious the editor's perspective on how best to tell a story that's clearly a compelling one, but in ways that the public can grab a hold of and help their public policymakers really understand both the urgency and sort of where we stand on these climate change related issues.
That's another great question. Thanks, Carl. Deb, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a really important one, because our window to actually positively affect the developments of climate change is narrow and closing all the time. You know, we've had an interesting discussion in journalism and in science journalism about coverage of climate change, and I'm going to kind of answer your question in two ways. If you go to the website of the British publication The Guardian, they are now running essentially a climate change advocacy series, and right when you go to their webpage, it'll say journalism has failed the world on covering climate change. We've seen this also at the Los Angeles Times, interestingly enough, where the editor of their opinion page announced they would no longer run letters to the editor from climate change deniers because the LA Times did not publish fiction. So you are, which is a very strong position.
Yeah.
So you are seeing journalists starting to say, there's a way we have to tell this story, and it can no longer be the kind of talking heads model of journalism, which is dictated by political reporting in which you have politician A on this side of the issue, politician B on this side of the issue, and to write a balanced story, you have to quote both. There's a lot of feeling in journalism that we did this for too long in climate change, that every time you wrote a story saying this is happening, that you had to then say, but here's a scientist who doesn't think that's true. So you're starting to see a shift in the way that journalists, science journalists, across the mainstream media tell these stories, in which what they are writing about is they're telling the stories in a way in which they're effectively saying this is real, that there's a scientific consensus on this, and this is real. And I think there's an ongoing debate about whether we started doing that soon enough. Because we certainly fed the ability of climate change denialism by allowing the public to think there was a scientific debate when, in fact, there was not. So that's part of the answer. We reframe the way we tell these stories. We don't go to the political model. The other one is the point you raise, which is also an excellent point, and that is people are influenced and remember better facts that are presented in story form. So our other job is to give examples of climate change events and predictions in a compelling, well-written, telling way. I included one New Yorker piece by Elizabeth Colbert in this collection, which is about looking at the fossil record and how it tells us where we're going in terms of climate change-driven extinctions today.
Yeah.
That became a book that she wrote called The Sixth Extinction, which won a Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction this year. I think we look more at building stories around those compelling evidence-based examples. And one of the things that I've been arguing in my, sort of multi-layered answer to your question is that we drill down to the local in telling these stories. People tend to actually recognize climate change effects when they see them. So that if you look at Climate Wisconsin, which is actually a website, you'll see that they'll look in Wisconsin at changes in the sugaring season. They'll look at changes in the trout fishing season. And I think the more that we, bring this back to what I said earlier, this is climate change affecting you today in your backyard, the more we're going to build a better consensus. And I think it's on us as communicators to do that more consistently and better.
Mm. Carl, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, very much for calling. I appreciate your call very, very much. We have other caller. Actually, you can join in, by the way. We'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Email from Kelly. This last year, I was chosen to be the lead editor of a 500-plus page feasibility study for the ocean cleanup. My job was to take the submissions of more than 50 scientists and engineers, most of them who speak English as a second language, and combine them into a coherent whole. The key here was that the study should be both interesting and understandable to policymakers and potential funders. I was surprised by how much I enjoyed this volunteer project. I've always been fascinated with communicating difficult topics well. Now I'm considering going back to get my PhD in communications. Can you talk about the field of science writing and what training is necessary?
Yeah, I'm, of course, a big fan of the field of science writing. And basically, that is not a one-size-fits-all kind of answer.
Yeah.
We get, there are a lot of really excellent people with a science background who become very successful science writers or bloggers. You know, some of the best sort of and most popular science bloggers are scientists. A lot of people, papers like the New York Times, those science writers are a mix of people with a science degree and people with not. So we see people who are like me, I am not a scientist, who love research and mm-hmm. likes to do her homework and finds it all fascinating. And we see scientists who bring a greater depth of understanding than someone like me and understands the culture of science, which is also important. If you look out across the field of science, journalism, science writing, science communicating at this moment, it's still a growing field. We see a lot of the new online publications are investing in it. BuzzFeed, for instance, which surprised everyone, hired a science desk of six national yeah. science writers, and they're continuing to build that over the last year. What you need to be a good science writer, there are a lot of programs that will train you in that from here at the University of Wisconsin mm-hmm. to NYU, to MIT, to Boston University, to Northwestern. There's a lot. I think the basic requirement is to be fearless about exploring science itself. You have to recognize when you're a science communicator that the most important audience is not the scientist you interview, but the people you're telling the story to. So we don't write to our sources, and we're willing to ask the questions that really open up and illuminate science as a human profession. The other thing you have to do is be a really good storyteller and be fearless in thinking about ways that you can tell that story most effectively. And that's one of the things that, you know, journalism schools like Wisconsin can do really well.
Yeah.
They can help you do that. And everyone I know who sort of transcends the background noise in science communication, I think, brings that to it, the fearlessness of inquiry and openness in communicating the best way you can.
And I think, you know, if you look at your book, the Best American Science and Nature Writing, for Kelly, Deb has just described the process, and for ways to see how that process is implemented very well in a variety of ways, you only have to pick this book up and read the pieces in it.
That's right. It's a huge variety of kind of approaches and ideas about how to tell a story. I mean, it's kind of amazing to see the way different people interested in science kind of pull you into a story. You mentioned that a couple of these stories, though, resonated for you, Larry.
Yeah.
And I wish you would tell one of those stories.
Well, you know, I read Awakenings, which was a piece about, it starts about a woman waking up or having night frights. And sort of it goes back, it winds up being something that had happened to me. And she had surgery, she had appendicitis, and had woken up during the surgery. And this had some deep impact on her. I had my appendix out, and as a matter of fact, I had my appendix out the night before my first final exam as a freshman in college, and so I missed all five of my exams. That's a whole other story.
I had to make up for that.
But I woke up during my surgery, and I remember looking and watching the surgeon, Dr. Schoenbeck, and finally he said, he's awake. And They hadn't been talking. I was aware of hand me this or you know that, but and then whoever was in charge of putting me back to sleep did it pretty quickly. But it didn't have an effect on me at all. But reading this piece was really fascinating about the number of people who are affected and who do wake up during surgery.
Yeah, wasn't that interesting? That was Joshua Lang. I think that was in The Atlantic. Yeah. And it turned out when you looked at the numbers that one or two out of every 1,000 people experience floats into kind of a conscious awareness while they're under anesthesia. I had no idea it was that many.
That's a lot, actually.
Yes. And then when you look at the percentage who have a negative consequence of that, that was high, too. I mean, that really surprised me. And some of that is, I think, well, surgery is a traumatic procedure. But what was really fascinating to me is that writer kind of explored consciousness during surgery was that it's really an exploration of our mysterious brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
No one expected this. Everyone thought that when you were unconscious under anesthesia, you were basically, you know, floating out there in another part of the universe, disconnected from where you are. And so a lot of that story, this is my favorite. I mean, I liked the good stories of people, you know, having these different events, but I really liked the way it says, but how does our brain work? Do we get that at all? It was really cool. And I'm going, no, not really.
Well, I can remember there was no pain involved when I was laying there. So, I mean, I was aware that something was being done, but I could feel no pain.
That is really fascinating.
Another story for me, and this kind of goes back to my days, I was raised, my first 13 years of my life, we were on a farm. And we had no money. We had my parents. In the end, my mom wound up at the university here, and my dad had another position. But back in those days, early on, we had no money. And my father trapped. And so reading the piece that you included on trapping, and I'm sure some people say, well, why would you, in this science anthology, include a piece on trapping? But you had pretty good reasons for doing that, I think.
I love that piece. It's written by an Ojibwe white writer,
yeah,
in which he explores sort of the cultural history of trapping by the Ojibwe, and he explores the different animals they trapped. It's really a piece of natural history writing as much, you know, sort of stretching the boundaries of science writing, which I like to do. And there were a couple of reasons that I thought that it was an exceptional piece. One, the guy's an amazing writer.
Yes.
And he just has this gift for putting you right in the moment when you're following an animal or looking at a trap. And he writes with respect for trapping. He doesn't, you know, argue that it's some glorious return to nature in the Ojibwe tradition, or even that, you know, it represents this kind of communal respect for the wild world that people have sometimes suggested was uniquely Native American. I mean, he just sets that aside. But he looks at the tradition of trapping, why we do it, describes how we do it in very precise scientific ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about the animals themselves, beavers and foxes. And he makes you see the other point that to me was so compelling in this piece, because I think it's important, was that he makes you see that we're not that different from them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, in the way their bodies are, in the way they respond, in the thump of their heart. I won't give away the closing scene, but the closing scene with this fox that they captured
is unbelievable. Unbelievable closing scene. And Kelly, you should be reading that one.
Yes. Every science writer and everyone who just finds the world a fascinating place should read that story.
There was a piece in that I enjoyed and made me talk about why brains prefer paper. And, you know, I still like to, I have the daily newspaper delivered to my house because I like to pick up the paper and actually read it. And I'll still read other papers online and so forth, but there's something about having paper. And who's the author?
Ferris Jabbar. He was with Scientific American. And he's a young science writer. He's a guy who fully came to age in the digital age, whereas I grew up earlier than that. And I grew up with paper, so part of it for me, I love books, and I love the feel of a book in my hand.
Yeah.
And there's a section in his story in which he talks about, he's looking at all the different scientific studies that analyze the difference in the way we respond to a story told digitally and a story we're told in a book. And one of the points he makes is our brains orient us better with a book. We actually have a physical response to the weight of the book in our hand and a sense of where we are in the story that it's very difficult to get digitally. So and I find that's true too. The way we navigate a story is partly a physical response. And there's a wonderful thing that he talks about he compares that to handwriting, where handwriting activates our storytelling brain in a way that typing does not. So it's just a reminder that we're still figuring these things out. But yes to paper books.
I'm with you on that for sure. Jocelyn in Sheboygan, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I've been concerned, for many years, that hardly anyone, I remember Dr. Paul Ehrlich discussing this on Johnny Carson's show about the danger of overpopulation of human beings on the planet. I mean, we're now over 7 billion. We're causing tremendous pressure on the planet and indirectly and directly killing off other species much, much quicker, 10 to 1,000 times quicker than the normal nature-caused extinction, like from the dinosaurs and all that. I find it criminal. I don't know why everyone is so afraid to. It's just crazy. We just can't handle. And they're saying it's going to be 9 billion and then 11 billion. You know, I either hear it on the radio. I heard a woman the other day, an author that wrote a book. Oh, I can't remember the, I think it was How Animals Grieve. And she's an anthropologist, and she called us invasive species. And I thought, what is she talking about? And then the more I thought about it, everything the way we describe invasive species, plant or animal, is exactly what we do to the earth.
Yeah.
That's a great point. In fact, the anthropologist you're talking about, Barbara King, who writes about how animals grieve, is one of the selections in my book. But the bigger problem of overpopulation, you're completely right. You know, Paul Ehrlich wrote back in the last century a book called The Population Bomb. And one of the reasons I think his message failed is that he was focused on a more Malthusian kind of idea that we were going to overpopulate until we basically starved ourselves to death. But we're effectively, partly because of science and technology, an invasive species because we figured out ways to overcome those feeding obstacles through science and technology. And so populations have grown and sustained. And you're absolutely right that a lot of the issues that we're talking about from climate change on are because there's a lot of people affecting life on this planet. And so you'll see, and this kind of also weaves through my collection, but you'll see it more commonly discussed that people will talk about the era that we're living in now is the Anthropocene. The era of the Earth's age that is human-influenced era. And a lot of people are saying, you know, we've got this accelerating power pattern of extinctions. We have acidification of the oceans. We have overfishing. We have climate change. We have, you know, not just severe drought, but severe drought in areas where the population is not sustainable without water, right?
Yeah.
Millions
yeah.
of people in those areas with actually not very good answers to any of those. And yes, those are consequences of the fact that, in fact, one of our abilities through science and technology is to overrun the planet, right? And I'm not sure what the long-term I hope that we pay more attention to that issue. And I'm going to tell you, frankly, I think that's a very difficult issue politically and socially to manage on this planet.
And maybe that's why we're not seeing a lot of writing about it. It really is hard to manage.
And the problem is that people want to write about things in which they can suggest a solution, right? You want to say, here's a problem and here's how we solve it. And you see people sidestepping this issue in part because they don't know how to fix it, right? Do you tell people not to procreate? Do you have governments? Do you reshuffle the social order of the planet in some way? I don't think we have an answer to it while acknowledging that you are absolutely right, and it is a big issue. People will call species like ours, we're survivor species, we're invasive species, you know, roaches and rats and humans, right? Raccoons, coyotes, right? We're in that mix. It will inherit whatever's left of the earth.
Well, in the meantime, we can enjoy some wonderful writing about science. And in your book, The Best American Science and Nature Writing, Deb. And it's always a pleasure to have you come and talk with us about science and science writing. Are you working on another book these days?
I'm working on the book that I always describe to myself as the book that will never get finished. But it is, I'm about two-thirds of the way through a manuscript on a book on the early history of food safety. It's right around the turn of the 20th century. It's Teddy Roosevelt and experiments on government employees, getting them to eat poisonous food. And all. It's a great story if I ever finish it, right?
Oh, well, I hope you finish it. And when you finish it, you have to come here first and be with us.
You would be absolutely the first.
Thank you, Deb.
Thank you.
Deborah Blum, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, author of many books, including The Poisoner's Handbook, which is one of my favorites. And this is the book we kind of talked about today, The Best American Science and Nature Writing of 2014. Deb was the editor of that. And if you haven't had a chance to look at it, please get a copy. Take a look. It is really some wonderful writing. We have some wonderful weather guys coming up next, and we're actually going to pick up on a topic that we talked about with Deb a little bit, which has to do with global climate change and some of the issues surrounding it. Among other things, I'm sure we'll talk about tornadoes and why the Weather Service banned that term, tornadoes. When was that? 1950, I think it was. Something like that. Deb says, yeah, that's when it happened. Well, you stay with us because there's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.